This is the lecture tape for November 3rd, 1999. We're in the book of Judges, and we're continuing on with Samson now. This is his birth and his marriage. When we were back in chapter 10, the author of Judges introduced the Ammonite and the Philistine threats to Israel. And last week we dealt with Jephthah and the Ammonites, and now we are continuing with the same story with Samson and the far more formidable enemy, the Philistines. Now, the Philistines first came onto the scene in the story of Shamgar, and you remember that he killed 600 Philistines with his ox goad. And the story of Samson, we will see that although he isn't able to deliver Israel completely from these people, he's able to keep them in check temporarily. I'd just like to read you some information on who the Philistines are. This comes out of the Bible as History by Werner Keller. And it says, "The Philistine people, who played a distinctive role in the life of Israel, were for a long time wrapped in mystery. It's only quite recently that it's been possible to find out something about them. Bit by bit, as the result of careful examination of the fruits of scientific research, the picture has become clearer. Fragments of pottery, inscriptions in temples, and traces of burnt-out cities give us a mosaic depicting the first appearance of these Philistines, which is unrivaled in its dramatic effect. Terrifying reports heralded the approach of these alien people. Messengers brought evil tidings of these unknown strangers who appear on the edge of the civilized ancient world, on the coast of Greece. Ox wagons, heavy carts with solid wheels, drawn by humpbacked bullocks, piled high with household utensils and furniture, accompanied by women and children, made their steady advance. In front marched armed men. They carried round shields and bronze swords. A thick cloud of dust enveloped them, for there were masses of them. Nobody knew where they came from. The enormous trek was first sighted at the Sea of Marmora. From there it made its way southward along the Mediterranean coast. On its green waters sailed a proud fleet in the same direction, a host of ships with high prows and a cargo of armed men. Wherever this terrified procession halted, it left behind a trail of burning houses, ruined cities, and devastated crops. No man could stop these foreigners. They smashed all resistance. In Asia Minor, towns and settlements fell before them. The mighty fortresses were destroyed. The magnificent stud horses of Cilicia were seized as plunder. The treasures of the silver mines of Tarsus were looted, and the carefully guarded secret of the manufacturing of iron, the most valuable metal of the time, was wrestled from the foundries beside the ore deposits. Under the impact of these shocking, one of the three great powers of the second millennium BC collapsed. The Hittite Empire was totally obliterated. The Philistines seemed to come out of nowhere, and they began to take over the civilized world. We saw their advanced technology, beginning with the heavy ox carts that had solid wheels. They had sailing ships, and we have to remember at this time nobody was on the water. The Egyptians had barges that went up and down the Nile, but certainly nobody could travel across an ocean. And the technology to make bronze and iron fighting implements made them virtually unstoppable. Because they came on the water, then they were referred to as the sea people. Further on in this book, their stature is taken off an Egyptian relief, and they're said to be tall, slim figures, at least a head taller than any of the Egyptians, and they had special type of dress, weapons, and battle tactics. So at this point, they are settling in now along the eastern Mediterranean coast, and they're establishing a Pentapolis, which is five Confederate cities. And if you look on your map today, you'll see they're actually on the coast of the tribe of Judah, but they start conquering the lands around them, and Dan, which is one of the weakest tribes, is the one that they begin to go after. So it's inevitable when you think about Israel, who's trying to build a nation, and now the Philistines, who are trying to take over this same land, that the nations would begin to clash. Well, we're also introduced to Samson. So who's Samson? Well, we find out today that he's certainly not a typical judge, but then I got to thinking, what's typical? We haven't seen a typical one yet, but at least in the book of Judges, we find that his role is much different than what we've seen. First off, he doesn't judge any people in the legal sense, nor does he lead any kind of army into battle. But we find that he is called of God, just as the other judges were, but his call was prior to his birth. And then he's going to serve as a one-man army and judge. We all know of his legendary strength and strong passions, because that is what God uses, but it brings him into a lot of clashes with the Philistines. His career as a judge could probably be characterized as personal revenge and counter-revenge. Yet somehow God's able to use him to stop the Philistines from going into the hill country of Israel. So our story begins today with chapter 12, and we find these familiar words again. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. The Philistines are now the oppressors, and it's been going on much longer than we've seen before. This is a full generation. We're already into 40 years of oppression. We're given the details around Samson's birth in verse 2. A certain man of Zorah named Manoah, which means rest or quiet, from the clan of the Danites, had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. Now this remain childless is to emphasize the fact that this is a long time. They are an older couple. The city of Zor is a secluded mountain village somewhere west of Jerusalem, of course in Dan. And we find here now in the midst of evil, which we read about in verse 1, that there's a family who is faithful to the Lord. We read that one day, as Manoah's wife is alone out in the fields, probably going about her daily chores, the angel of the Lord appeared to her and said she was about to have a child, and he would be a Nazarite, one who's consecrated to the Lord from birth, and would begin to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines. Once again, the angel of the Lord, as we find as we continue on, is a theophany. This is again an appearance of the Lord before he's born of Mary. Well, after the angel of the Lord appears to Manoah's wife, look at verse 6. Then the woman went to her husband and told him, "A man of God came to me. He looked like an angel of God, very awesome. I didn't ask him where he came from, and he didn't tell me his name, but he said this to me, 'You will conceive and give birth to a son. Now then drink no wine or other fermented drink, and do not eat anything unclean, because the boy will be a Nazarite of God from birth until the day of his death.'" I love this. It says she immediately went to her husband. I think she probably ran to him. And then, don't you love her intro? She goes before her husband and she knows what he's going to say, so she starts right out. "This man came to me. I think he was a man of God. Don't know, and I didn't ask him. But listen to what he said. We're going to have a baby, and I can't eat anything unclean because he's going to be a Nazarite." Notice that she forgets to put anything in there about his delivering of Israel. I want you to look at Manoah's response in verse 8. He's just heard the information from his wife, and we read, "Then Manoah prayed to Yahweh, 'O Lord, I beg you, let this man of God you sent to us come again to teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born.'" Notice he accepts the news without question, and he immediately goes before the Lord in prayer and asks for an opportunity to speak to the man of God, and the terminology is that he believes it's a prophet. And we find God answering his prayer, and he appears again to the woman. But this time she's no more prepared. She asks him to stay while she gets her husband. Look at verse 11. "Then Manoah got up and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said, 'Are you the one who was talking to my wife?' 'I am,' he said. So Manoah asked him, 'When your words are fulfilled, what is to be the rule for the boy's life and work?'" Now Manoah again doesn't question the word. He says, "When it's fulfilled." But what he wants to know is, "What is my part? I know what my wife's part is. She has to live her life as a Nazarite. But what's my part? How do I raise the boy?" Because remember, it's the father's role to teach the son the law and to give him a trade. But the angel of the Lord repeats to Manoah that his wife is to do exactly what he told her, that the child is to be a Nazarite from birth. And you saw the Nazarite vows when we went through Numbers 6. Basically, a Nazarite vow was voluntary. It was to set oneself apart for God for a specific period. And during that time, there was three stipulations. They couldn't have any products from the vine. They couldn't cut their hair during the period of the vow. And this was for a physical sign, so everybody would know. And they didn't come in contact with a dead body. Now, if any of these stipulations were broken, then the vow was nullified, but you still had to keep the vow, so you basically went back to day one and had to start all over again. And if you had like a year vow and you got to 11 months and 20 days and accidentally had an animal die while you were out in the field, you would have to start over with day one and do the full year over again. Most vows were personal and for a very short period of time, but we see Samson's vow was for life, and it certainly wasn't voluntary. And since his state was a special category, his mother, while she was pregnant and nursing him, had to also abstain from anything from the vine and not come across anything that was dead so that it wouldn't defile the baby. Now, it's interesting because the high priest had these stipulations permanently. The high priest could not drink of the vine, and he could not come near anything dead because he had to always be available to go and intercede for the people on behalf of God. And if he came across anything dead, it would be a 7-day defilement, and he couldn't be in the presence of the Lord during that time. Also, wine was the staple. It was the main drink. They didn't drink water because they didn't have access to it, so this was very difficult for them to do this. Well, we find that this time the messenger is treated with great respect, but no recognition. In verse 15, Manoah says to the angel of the Lord, "We would like you to stay until we prepare a young goat for you." Now, what Manoah is doing is he's offering hospitality and friendship. But the angel declines to accept the meal and then says, if he wants to, he could bring a burnt offering before the Lord, which is a thanksgiving offering. Now Manoah doesn't know what to think. So he says, "What's your name? So that we can honor you when the words come true." But he's told the name is too wonderful, beyond understanding. I want you to notice here that Manoah is only given the information that God knows is necessary for him to have. He's given no information to satisfy his curiosity. God only gave him what he needed to have. So at this point, Manoah goes and prepares the sacrifice and brings it to the angel. And he puts it on the rock as the angel directs. And if you think back to the story of Gideon, Gideon also brought a sacrifice before the angel of the Lord. But it's different here because the angel of the Lord in the Gideon story touched the sacrifice with his staff, and immediately flame shot out, and then the angel of the Lord went up into the flames to heaven. Here it appears that Manoah is just going about it in the normal way. He would be stacking the wood and lighting the fire. And it's this point that the incredible incident comes to its climax, because Manoah's doing the sacrifice just normally, and all of a sudden the angel goes up in the flames over the altar and is gone. Now immediate recognition sets in. Manoah and his wife fall face down, absolutely terrified. Manoah's the first one to speak, and he says, "We're going to die. We've seen the face of God, now we're going to die." But his wife, who has already had the advantage of seeing the angel twice and is still alive, says, "No, I don't think that's true, because God accepted our sacrifice. He wouldn't have accepted it if he was going to kill us. Besides, he came here to tell us that we were about to have a son. Why would he bring a promise if he knew he was just going to kill us?" Well, true to God's words, Manoah's wife gave birth to a son, and they named him Samson, which is Shemesh, and it means the little son. What's interesting about this is the town of Beth Shemen, which is house of the little son, is a town across the valley from Zoar, and it had a shrine to the sun god there. Now, Shemesh or Samson was a very popular name, so the Israelites took it from the Canaanites and used it. It's probably like in my generation, the name Mary, Kathy, Bill, and John seemed to be very, very popular, and so everybody was naming their children that. We don't see any indication that they worshipped the sun god, certainly not, because they are faithful followers of the Lord here. We find that he grows and is blessed by the Lord both in body and mind, and that reminds us, of course, of Jesus in the New Testament. And when he grew up, we're told the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him for action. Well, when we get to chapter 14, we find in spite of the oppression, Samson seems to have freedom to travel. Look at 14 verse 1. It says, Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. Timnah is about 3 or 4 miles southwest of Zoar. And at verse 2 we read, when he returned, he said to his father and mother, I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. It's the role of the father to provide a wife for his son and make all the necessary arrangements through negotiations with the father of the intended bride. But we find his parents voicing their concern in verse 3. His father and mother replied, Isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? The grief of his parents can only be imagined, especially with the knowledge of his unique birth and God's laws regarding marrying pagans, which was absolutely forbidden. But look at, we see not only Samson's lack of concern for the religious issues, but he also doesn't submit to his parents. And we know the Ten Commandments said children were to obey their parents. And in Israelite society, the father was the head of the family. And as such, he was the one that exercised the control over the choice of wives for his sons. It was the exception that a son would ever choose his own wife. Certainly he would never dismiss his parents' desires. And here we find he does so with a pagan woman. It seems to be a case of love at first sight, because Samson says, I saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines, and he wanted to marry her. His reason is, she pleases me well. The literal translation is, she looks right in my eyes. Samson was concerned about his own desires, not of the Lord. His parents' concern is that she is an uncircumcised Philistine. Now, this is a term that's used many times in the Old Testament. I was curious about this. I thought the only ones that were circumcised were the Israelites. That was given as the sign of the covenant. But I found out that all their neighbors around them, with the exception of the Philistines, were circumcised. However, there was an importance. In Israel, a baby boy on the eighth day is circumcised and given his name, and that is the sign of the covenant. The neighbors around them used that kind of as a rite of passage into manhood. They were circumcised just prior to their marriage. When you get further away, like down into Egypt, circumcision was practiced, but only on the priests and the ruling class. The ordinary folks wouldn't be involved in such a thing. Well, as we go on with verses 5 to 7, we come across the lion. It says, Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and his mother, and as they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring towards him. Now, I have several problems with this passage, because first it starts out, when they went down together, which is plural, it ends up that all of a sudden he's alone, singular. It appears some way along the line Samson separates from his family and meets a young lion, and this young lion is the fiercest of sorts. It's a 1 to 2 year old male. Quite possibly they were coming with gifts, and if so, they might have had caravans, and the parents would either be slower behind or possibly they were in front. But the second thing that bothered me is Samson was a Nazarite. He was not to have anything to do with the grapes, and I wondered what he was doing in the vineyards of Timnah. But the point of the story here is that when the lion came out, it was a young lion, the fiercest, indicating that Samson or any man was absolutely no match for the lion. It was only when the Spirit of the Lord comes mightily upon him that he has the power to overcome it. And we're told he tore it apart as if it was nothing more than a baby goat. The word picture here is tearing the lion down the middle. Presuming, starting with the hind legs, he just absolutely ripped it apart. And if you think about it, that's the way the animals were divided for the sacrifice and for going through the blood path. They didn't cut them in the middle. They cut them from tail to nose so that they were divided in half. There appears to be some sort of time lapse, because Samson returns to Timnah and he's going by the vineyard again, and so he turns aside, which is to go off the main road, and he goes to look at the carcass. And to his and our amazement, he finds honey inside of this dead lion. Now, I asked Georgine Hollister about bees, because she's been a beekeeper for 16 years, And she pretty much confirmed what I had found in my research, and that's bees don't go near dead animals. But the location of this is kind of desert area, and there wouldn't have been a lot to eat for wild animals or birds of prey, and so anything killed would have been immediately devoured by the animals. And because of the intense heat and the sand and the rock there, a carcass becomes dehydrated very, very quickly. And once all the meat's gone and the animal's dehydrated, it actually is a structure, and bees are looking for some sort of structure to hang their hives on. And I also asked her, how long would it take for bees, when they first come, to make a hive before honeycomb is formed? And she said it takes as little as 2 days. So we don't have any idea how long this had been since Samson was there, but it could have been as little as a week. But we find that when he reaches it, he goes in and takes out the honeycomb. And both Georgine and I were curious about this because it doesn't record that he got stung at all. And bees are very fierce in protecting their homes, so they normally would have attacked. But since we don't read about that, Samson may have been immune. He seemed to have immunity to a lot of things in the story here. But what he is doing is willfully breaking his Nazirite vow, because not only is he touching a corpse, he's actually going inside of it. And this would be the reason why he doesn't tell his parents where he got the honey from. Once again, the question comes up into my mind, after he's been filled with the Holy Spirit, how can he do things like this? And what I found just confirms what I've been thinking all along, and that's the outpouring of the Holy Spirit does not automatically make one godly. What it does is gives the resources to be godly, but it doesn't do it for you. A person can be wonderfully gifted by the Holy Spirit and yet still spiritually immature, and that's, I think, what we see here in Samson. Well, we then come to the wedding and the feast in verse 10. It says, now his father went down to see the woman. Interesting here, the woman here is not a virgin, as we would expect the young bride to be, but it's a common word used for either a widow or a divorced person. And what his father was probably doing was trying to stop the marriage. We can't be 100% sure of this, but it appears that that might be what he's doing. Many of the details have been omitted by the story, and marriage customs have changed over the time, but it is very obvious that this is not a typical Israelite wedding. Young people normally did not decide who they would marry. In fact, it was a marriage first and love came afterwards, and this is what produced a stable marriage in that area. Arrangements for a marriage were always initiated by the groom's father, and he would go to the bride's father, and they would negotiate a bride price. The arrangements had to be made for the work compensation to be paid to the woman's family, which is a dowry that is given to the bride's father, because he's losing a worker and his wife. The women did the majority of the work. The dowry would be paid to the woman's family, but her father couldn't use the dowry, only any interest on it. And what the dowry was done is it was kept in safekeeping for the bride in the event that she would become a widow or divorced without a son to care for her. And then that would be her protection, a way to take care of herself without a son. Interesting in this section here, because if the bride price included something like animals or, say, goats, maybe the bride price included 10 goats, the father could not use those 10 goats. But if those 10 goats produced animals or babies, then the babies would become the father's property, but he would always have to keep, over time, 10 goats as part of the dowry. So he would not be able to sell those, but had to keep them. Not the same goats, but the same amount. Well, once the bride price was paid, then the contract was sealed, and they were essentially considered married, and that's why we see that. It talks about the husband and the wife, and you're going, but they didn't go through the marriage ceremony. Well, you're right, but once the bride price was paid, they were essentially married, and in order to break that, they actually had to go through the legal proceedings of a divorce. It also explains why polygamy was not being practiced, except in rare instances. The reason we read about them in the Bible is because it was very rare that they did that, because it was very costly to have a bride. And so if you had more than one bride, you had to be very, very wealthy. Now, the very, very poor could not even pay a price. And so as we saw in the case of Jacob, when he fled from his home, he had nothing to give to Laban for Rachel. And so instead of a bride price, he served his father-in-law for 7 years free in order to earn his bride. Usually once this engagement began, it would be about a year before the wedding took place. And during that time, the groom would go to his father's home and prepare his own house. And when his house was ready, he would go back and claim his bride. When that was complete, then the wedding took place. And what I found so curious was the wedding didn't require any rabbi or priest until just recently, because the contract had already been sealed. They essentially were already married once the bride price was paid. The wedding itself included a 7-day festivity, at which time the bride and groom would play the part of a king and queen. They dressed the part and they would sit under a canopy like a big throne. But it all began when the groom had finished his home and he went with his groomsmen to the bride's house. She would then come out with a veil, and sometime during that day the veil would be removed from the bride and placed across the groom's shoulders. And the words, "The government shall be upon his shoulder," were spoken. And that's interesting because that's the prophecy of Isaiah, and that's exactly what Jesus fulfilled. But it's all part of the wedding ceremony. Then the process would continue where the bride and all the people would go then to the groom's family's home. And there would be dancing and joy in the street as the procession continued on. And it's at the groom's house that the 7-day festivities took place. But here in Samson's case, we find it's all taking place at the bride's house, showing that this is not a normal marriage. And as we learned last week, it's an inferior marriage, like the concubine of Gideon. This bride would not be joining her husband's family, but would remain with her own people and would be visited from time to time by her husband. I also found out that the Palestinian Arabs do that today, but they consider it a true marriage, but without permanent cohabitation. The woman actually becomes the mistress of her own home, and her husband is known as a visiting husband, and he comes to her home as a guest, and when he does, he comes bringing gifts. Well, we read that Samson made a feast there, as was customary for the bridegroom. This is literally a drinking feast. And if Samson didn't break his Nazarite vows by partaking in the wine, he certainly put himself in a situation where there would be far too easy to do so. In verse 11, we're told he's given 30 companions. This was an interesting custom. The companions were actually sons of the bride's chamber, or they were Philistines, and they served as bodyguards. Because when this drinking and festivity was going on, it was easy for bandits to look for wedding parties and then go in and find them easy prey. So the text, though, suggests this is a little different from the normal proceedings. It seems to be these men were engaged to serve as bodyguards, but to protect them from Samson. Very interesting. Another interesting custom in Israel is that wealthy families would provide their guests with garments for the wedding. But what we find is Samson doesn't seem to be the one to follow rules. So what he's doing is he ties a form of entertainment that was used during weddings, which was riddles, to the provision of garments. It was customary to give riddles during weddings, something to intrigue their minds, but certainly not to use them as wages. But we find the challenge is readily accepted. They probably thought, well, 30 of us putting our heads together, we could certainly solve this riddle. But the stakes are very high because it not only includes the outer fancy garments, but we see it also as the undergarments, which is a large rectangular piece of linen which they wore day and night. And the average person only had one change of garments. And we find that they were highly prized and they were actually spoils of war. When they went into battle, they wore their finery to show their wealth and their power and to intimidate. But when they were captured, their garments then were taken as spoils of war. So Samson's riddle is, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now God had commanded his people not to have any dealings with the pagans around them. And here was Samson, the one that God had chosen to be the deliverer of the nation, ready to marry a Philistine, feasting with them and joking and laughing with the enemy that's actually been oppressing God's people for over 40 years. Well, by the third day, the riddle proves unsolvable, as it was tended to, because only Samson knows the answer. And it's not surprising, when faced with the expense that these guests are going to have, that the festive atmosphere turns ugly. Look at verse 15. On the fourth day, they say to Samson's wife, "Coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we will burn you and your father's household to death. Did you invite us here just to rob us?" So we find that Samson's wife cooperates with the Philistines. Now, the reason is probably complicated. Obviously, she's acting out of fear. But I wondered what would have happened if she had gone to Samson and told him about the threats. I have a feeling he probably could have handled the situation. And I wondered if maybe she wasn't afraid of Samson's, too. We find she begins with begging, then the tears, and finally, "You really don't love me?" Well, Samson assures her that love has absolutely nothing to do with it, and he doesn't even tell his parents. But by the seventh day, he can't take her nagging anymore. So just prior to the end of the contest, which is sunset, he tells her the answer to the riddle. Well, she immediately goes to the guests with the answer, and look at verse 18. The men of the town said to him, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And Samson said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Samson's angry and bitter and felt manipulated. The word heifer here is a very derogatory word for a wife who betrays her husband. Samson's wife got what she wanted through manipulation, but in the same time she lost her husband's heart. Angered by both his wife and the Philistines, we find that the Spirit of the Lord once again comes upon him. He goes 23 miles to the coast of one of the five royal cities of the Philistines in Ashkelon. There he kills 30 men and takes their garments. I wondered why he didn't go any closer, but apparently if he did, it wouldn't be too hard to figure out who had done this, and they would take the vengeance out on his family at Zoar. So Samson now returns with the garments, pays his debt, and then goes home, to his own home, with feelings of rage towards his wife. Now, I want you to understand, this is the end of the seventh day. This is supposed to be the wedding night, the time when the marriage is consummated and they actually begin to live as husband and wife. But the groom's gone. It's a little like leaving the bride at the altar. And it was considered a disgrace. And she would be embarrassed. And in order to save face, her father gives her to the Philistine who had been Samson's best man. Very interesting way to end this chapter, isn't it? Well, we're going to continue our story next week. But Samson thought he could take matters into his own hands, even though God had forbidden him or anyone in Israel to marry a non-Israelite, but most especially a Nazirite. But what I want us to see here is that God used Samson despite his sin, not because of it, but despite it, in order to bring about the process that he had called and prepared Samson for, which was to stop the Philistine domination of Israel. I don't believe it was God's plan that he would marry a Philistine woman. I believe God had a plan that would not violate his laws. As our story continues next week, we will see that God does use Samson mightily, but I wondered how much more could have been accomplished if Samson had followed God's plans and been the clean vessel that God had called him to be. He reminded me of another young man in the Bible, in the New Testament. His name was Timothy, and his mentor, the Apostle Paul, gave some counsel to Timothy about being used of God. He says, "If you keep yourself pure, you will be a utensil God can use for his purposes. Your life will be clean, and you will be ready for the Master to use you for every good work. Run from anything that stimulates youthful lust. Follow anything that makes you want to do right. Pursue faith and love and peace, and enjoy the companionship of those who call on the Lord with pure hearts." That's 2 Timothy 2:21 and 22. God's desire is to have all his children be clean with pure hearts, so that when he calls, we're ready to do his will.